From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm David Andrietta, in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made as we speak, at warp speed, in fact, as scientists around the world race to devise a vaccine for the novel coronavirus and, ideally, put an end to the global pandemic. Governments have poured billions of dollars into the pursuit, and the leaders of the major powers, namely the United States, China, and Russia, are treating the effort as a proxy war for their personal stewardship of their countries. Russia, of course, announced last week that it had approved a vaccine, although global health authorities say it has yet to complete critical late-stage clinical trials that would determine its safety and effectiveness. For his part, President Putin says the vaccine, quote, works effectively enough, and his health minister has said the country will begin a mass vaccination campaign this fall that would begin by administering the vaccine to medical workers and teachers this month. A vaccine is seen as the most likely avenue for alleviating the worldwide health crisis that has infected roughly 22 million people and killed nearly 800,000 and decimated economies. Around the world, there are reportedly more than 165 vaccines in development, and more than 30 vaccines are in various stages of human trials. Eight of those have entered the final phase of mass human testing, including here in the United States. Dr. Anthony Fauci recently testified before Congress that he's confident a vaccine will be ready by early 2021, although he said yesterday that he doesn't see the country mandating that it be taken. Meanwhile, a Gallup poll released this month found that more than one in three Americans wouldn't get vaccinated even if one were approved. You know, we often think of healthcare professionals as being on the front line of this war against the disease, and rightfully so. But the thousands of people who have volunteered to participate in the human trials of vaccines and those people who coordinate them are foot soldiers, too. Today, we talked to some of those soldiers. I'm pleased to welcome to the program four guests, and we'll start with Dr. Ed Walsh. Dr. Walsh, he's the head of infectious diseases at Rochester General Hospital and a professor of infectious diseases at the University of Rochester Medical Center, who is on the URMC's vaccine research team. Dr. Walsh, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Phyllis Jackson, a registered nurse and the Community Wellness Project Manager at Common Ground Health. She's going to talk to us about the racial disparities in participation rates for vaccine trials, where the bulk of participants are white, in spite of a wide body of evidence that COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting people of color. A valuable conversation to have, and I'm delighted that you're joining us, Phyllis.
Thank you very much.
Also with, thank you. Also with us is Corey Talenda, a coronavirus vaccine trial participant here in Rochester. Corey, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here.
And we also have with us John Gunn, a PhD who is a professor in the Department of Microbiology at The Ohio State University and principal investigator at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, and a coronavirus vaccine trial participant in that city. John, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Walsh, I want to begin with you and ask where we stand with the vaccine trials in Rochester. It's my understanding that the trial here involves a potential vaccine developed by Pfizer, although there may be others being tested that I don't know about. What's the update? This is a sort of a multi-pronged question here. What's the update? How are things going? How many people are participating? What kind of response have you seen? Can you give us a rundown?
Yes, I can give you a rundown on all of those questions. So thus far, the Pfizer vaccine has been the only one tested in the Rochester area to date. That situation will change as we go forward. The phase one study of the Pfizer vaccine, which is a messenger RNA vaccine, which is very analogous to the Moderna vaccine, began in June in Rochester, and those trial of phase one was completed in the early part of June. In the early part of August, and we began then phase three trials at that or trial at that time. Next vaccine that seems to be imminent in the Rochester area will be the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is being run through the University of Rochester's Vaccine Trials and Evaluation Unit. And it is the vaccine that It gained a lot of press early on in the pandemic in April and May, and known as the Oxford vaccine from Oxford, England. Thus far in the Pfizer Phase 1 study here in Rochester, we enrolled 48 individuals at several different doses to seek out the appropriate dose and also to look at any side effects that occur with those, as well as the immunogenicity. And those are the two factors which would then be used to decide on which vaccine dose and frequency to move forward with into the phase three. And so that decision was made in late July, and so we began the phase three study. At this point, we've enrolled approximately 115 to 120 subjects into that trial, and that is going forward at this time.
So a moment ago, I thought you had said that there were 48 individuals involved. Maybe I missed something.
In phase one. Okay. In phase one. And this is essentially the phase one study is known as a first-in-human trial generally. So this is when you have a new vaccine that has gone through animal testing and what we call preclinical trials, or testing, I should say, and then we move into humans when we think we have something that would be safe as well as potentially effective. And so the phase one studies are very critically important to assess early on whether the vaccine has the potential to give the benefit that you're going to be looking for. However, it's the phase three trial which will define whether the vaccine actually protects individuals from disease.
So I want to touch on that. How does that happen? How does a vaccine work? I think most people understand it, a vaccine, to be sort of introducing, and I'm going to take a really simplistic approach here, not being a medical professional. They understand a vaccine to be introducing a pathogen into the body and let it trigger an immune response and let the body fight it off. Am I close? How do you just determine whether a vaccine works?
Yeah, in a sense, you're close. I think that is a little bit simplistic. Generally speaking,
a lot simplistic.
What we essentially are trying to do is present to our immune system in this case, for instance, a protein. To which we want the person's immune system to recognize as a foreign protein and to produce antibodies as well as T cells that will recognize the shape, structure of the protein such that if you ever encounter it again, your antibodies and your T cells will recognize that protein being on the virus itself. And so it will attack it at that point and presumably prevent the infection from occurring. So that would be the explanation for what we are trying to do. And there's various ways to do this. The traditional vaccines, something like the first polio vaccines, they would take a virus and kill it, and then the viral particle, which contains proteins, and these proteins are what you are then inducing the antibody to. Later, the second polio vaccine was a live virus, but it was attenuated. And so in that case, you would actually infect the person with this weakened virus. That is not what's being done with the coronavirus vaccines.
It's just the protein.
No, and it's in the case of the two vaccines that we've mentioned so far, which are the Pfizer vaccine, which is a messenger RNA vaccine, as well as the AstraZeneca and Oxford vaccine, what they are doing is they are introducing the RNA that would allow your body to actually produce that protein itself. And there are several advantages of such a strategy. Rather than produce the protein in a laboratory and purify it, then put that in a syringe and give it to somebody, what we're doing is we're allowing the body to make the protein in an authentic version that is exactly what the virus would produce if the virus were to infect you. It is not, however, an actual infection with the messenger RNA vaccine.
Doctor, I want to stick with you just for a moment here. What does a typical timeline for a vaccine look like, and how does this one differ, if it differs at all?
Yeah, this one differs substantially, and it's the reason for that is because of the timeline of the pandemic. Of course, we don't know what would have happened or what would happen if there were the inability to produce the vaccine. For instance, in 1918, when the flu pandemic occurred, when we really didn't have the scientific capability of producing vaccines the way we do now. And so we don't know what the outcome would have been. But we have a situation now where we can assume that without a vaccine, this virus will continue to circulate, possibly for several years, and until it is essentially exhausted the supply of individuals who are not immune. And so you could see waves of this virus go on for potentially years. So we are, in a certain sense, trying to prevent those second events to occur. So we've already been through the spring where we've had, and now early summer, where we've had a lot of disease, and we're trying to get ahead of the virus. And so, therefore, the usual time frame of maybe 2 or 3 years to develop a vaccine has been compressed in order to catch up to where the epidemic is or the pandemic is. So that's been done in the development of all of these vaccines that are reaching clinical trials.
Corey Talenda, I want to turn to you. You are a participant in the Pfizer vaccine trial.
Yes, I am.
Some people have expressed concern that these trials are being moved along too quickly. I mean, the American effort is being dubbed Operation Warp Speed. Did you have any concerns about that in joining the trial?
For me, no. Actually, I have quite a bit of experience in emergency management. I used to be an EMT, so I know firsthand how important science and medicine is. Even though we have to, you know, compress the timeline, I'm still trusting in the process and the review of the results. So for me, I didn't have any issues with the compressed timeline.
So what has the process been like for you thus far?
Well, actually, I think we're very lucky in the Rochester area because URMC and Rochester Regional Health are leading healthcare providing organizations. And from the get-go of me being involved with this vaccine trial, they've been professional. When you arrive to the office, they provide you a lot of information. The nurses are kind. They walk you through the process. And, you know, just getting the shot is just like getting, you know, the flu
right.
shot every
and,
year.
And it's an injection.
Easy. Yeah, or injection, sorry.
Yeah.
On the injection, it's pretty easy. And then after that, you leave. So it was a very simple, informed process.
Any side effects? Any anything?
No, none for me.
Doctor, have you seen people with side effects to the vaccine?
Oh, absolutely. We would expect in some instances, and this is one of the things we're looking for. We expect to see some degree of pain at the site of the injection. It would not be unusual to have a low-grade temperature, for instance, perhaps feel a little bit achy the next day. And so this is why we also have a placebo group, so you can compare the two groups to see the difference. And what we learned from that is how well these vaccines can be tolerated. This is important, choosing the appropriate dose, one that not only stimulates the immune system the way you want to see it happen, but one in which, you know, the people who receive the vaccine, as Corey just mentioned, have minimal amount of symptoms. And each vaccine, for instance, that is available at this time for other infections will have a very different spectrum of side effects. And I think anyone who's raised children know that the childhood vaccine series often will result in some degree of fever and discomfort and sort of moodiness of the infant. So these are some of the side effects that you see in children. And in adults, it manifests sometimes as sort of an achiness the next day. You know, fortunately, thus far in the phase one study with the messenger RNA vaccine from Pfizer, as well as in our early phase three study that we're now halfway through the immunization period, we've seen really a very well-tolerated vaccine. In fact, the majority of the patients who we've immunized think they are receiving a placebo.
We've got phone calls coming in, and I should remind listeners, you can contact the show at 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994 or 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Of course, you can always email the program at connections@WXXI.org. And I have a question from Veronica in Rochester via email here that touches on the placebo. What happens to, her question is this exactly, what happens to the study participants when a vaccine is approved? Will they be told then whether they were given a vaccine or a placebo so they can get the vaccine if they were tested with the placebo?
Yeah, this is a somewhat unprecedented situation in that we have approximately 4 to 5 vaccine trials currently planned in phase three in the U.S., and then there are others going on internationally. This has never happened before, and it is something of some debate, well, not debate, but discussion, all the way from the FDA down to the ground here in Rochester among the investigators, and this discussion has taken place in our office with the vast majority of the subjects who've come in. And it is an issue that will need to be dealt with because the studies are designed to run for 2 years, and there are various reasons for that. Although the hope is that an answer as to whether the vaccines are effective at reducing illness, the hope is that we will have answers to that within, say, 6 months or perhaps less.
I was going to ask, do you share Dr. Fauci's optimism that a vaccine will be ready by early 2021?
Well, I think we are hopeful of that, and I think that the data thus far in the phase one studies certainly supports that optimism. But the proof really is dependent on the outcome in the phase three trials, and until that time, we can be very optimistic, but we do not have evidence, and we really do need this evidence that it is effective at either overall reducing infection, or at the very least, reducing pneumonia and the severity of the infection, which would then lead to a reduction in mortality, hospitalization, and long-term effects.
I want to touch on, sorry to interject, but I want to touch on the racial disparities in the research. But first, I do want to talk to John Gunn. He's joining us from The Ohio State University, patiently waiting on our panel here. He's a coronavirus vaccine trial participant in Columbus. John, how has your trial been treating you at this point?
So I'm also in the Pfizer vaccine. There's a local group here, a local company called Aventiv Research, who's running this trial for them. And so I was, I think early on in the people to get vaccinated. So so I received my first dose about 2 weeks ago and set for my second dose in about a week.
Were there any reservations on your part?
No, as a scientist, I've I read the publication that came out on the phase one studies, and I felt pretty confident going into it that that this was going to be something that was safe and hopefully effective. And I felt like as a scientist, I actually work on bacteria, not viruses. And I felt like it was something that I could do to help contribute to getting the pandemic under control.
Dr. Walsh, what have you seen thus far locally here in terms of the racial makeup of participants in the trial?
The racial makeup of the participants in the trial is approximately 8% African American and perhaps somewhat similar for Latino. This is, though, and I know you have on the phone Phyllis Jackson, this is a real concern that we have as investigators. As we all know, the disparity in terms of impact of the pandemic, and it's true for Rochester as well as for the country, has disproportionately affected individuals of various racial groups and ethnic groups. And this has this has resulted in an important effort that really needs to be carried out to include these individuals. But I would say that this is a difficult task. When you look at the mechanisms that we have today to get out and talk with groups, to meet with them in various social settings, these are all currently restricted because of the pandemic. So it becomes particularly difficult. And makes it difficult also because of the time compression. These trials are moving quickly, and some of the groundwork that would need to be done is compromised by the rate at which this is all moving.
As you mentioned, the racial disparities in medical research are well documented, and the reasons for that are very complicated. WXXI health reporter Brett Dahlberg talked to Dr. Ann Falsey at URMC about the barriers minority communities face when it comes to participating in medical research. Dr. Falsey is the co-director of URMC's Vaccine Treatment and Evaluation Unit. I believe you work closely with her. Dr. Walsh, I just want to hear a clip from Brett Dahlberg's discussion with Dr. Falsey for a moment.
We have been doing community outreach and doing community studios to understand what are the barriers and how to solve them. We have been reaching out to faith-based organizations. We have been consulting, again, with our leaders in the community to utilize different advertising strategies. It does take some time. And, so taking time to build trust when you're working at sort of light speed, warp speed, it is definitely a challenge.
So there you have it. That was Dr. Falsey of the URMC Vaccine Treatment and Evaluation Unit talking about the racial disparities in medical research, particularly these coronavirus vaccine trials, and the one in particular here, the Pfizer vaccine trial in Rochester. Phyllis Jackson, you're a nurse at Common Ground Health. You're also mm-hmm. with an organization called the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition that encourages people of color to participate in the COVID trials, or has been. How is that effort going?
Well, we just actually started that effort, and mainly because I was associated with a group that called out for people to participate in a studio, and it was around this COVID vaccine, which is like a focus group. And the presenter, one of the investigators was there, Dr. Branch from the University of Rochester. And Dr. Branch is a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so she came to speak to our Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition group. And that kind of started off thinking about, we really should do this. As a nurse and a clinician, I've always believed that we should participate, all people should participate, especially people of color. We're disproportionately affected by so many of the things that they're looking at for vaccine trials and they're looking for clinical trials, and yet we don't. That's documented, well documented why we don't, because we don't trust the system that administers these. But the other thing is that we don't trust when they design trials, and this one is fast moving, but in general, when the trials are designed, they're not designed actually to attract people of color. The literacy rate is very high and they're very complicated. You don't quite understand it. You don't see people of color involved in it. But the major point is that we have a history that we look back, and this is transgenerational history. It's passed down. We're people that, number one, are relational, are people that also have stories. And so
sure,
the stories have been passed on years and years. And so we all grow up with mistrust. We're taught that from a knee-high to a duck, as my grandmother used to say, that you can't trust the system. And so, therefore, when clinical trials come, you know, and they say, we need you to participate, we don't see anybody that looks like us, nobody's talking to us, what we read about it, we really don't understand because the literacy level is quite high. And then for you're not talking to people that have relationships in the community. And if you're talking to them, you're talking to them to get them to come out and go out and tell people to do a trial, and they themselves don't quite understand what you're talking about.
A lot of barriers, and I want to talk about them more right after the break, and I want to talk about your experience, your personal experience in signing up for the trial. I've got to take a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
I'm Megan Mack. Thursday on The Next Connections, a new report from researchers at Yale shows how racial covenants and racist property agreements have created segregation in Monroe County. Nearly every town in the county has seen the effects of racist property deeds, which stated people of color could not buy or occupy those homes. Our guests discuss the history of those covenants, the impact they've had on communities, and how to undo their effects. Talk to you Thursday.
You're listening to Connections. I'm David Andrietta, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the coronavirus vaccine trials underway in Rochester and around the country, and talking to the foot soldiers on the front lines, people participating in one way or another in the trials. And before the break, we were talking about the racial disparities, not only in just in medical research in general, but as they pertain to the coronavirus vaccine trials. We're speaking with Phyllis Jackson, a nurse at Common Ground Health, who is doing her best to encourage people of color in our community to participate in the trials. But that effort is complex, and the reasons for the medical research, the disparities in medical research are complicated. And you were talking a little bit about not trusting the system. Of course, we've heard the stories of the Tuskegee study and Henrietta Lacks. These are the types of stories that are passed down generationally that that instill this mistrust?
Absolutely. And the fact that people of color suffer aggression, microaggressions daily. And then you have a big assault like the pandemic, and it disproportionately affects us, which all major diseases do anyway, which is one of the underlying reasons why corona was so deadly for us. So having suffered that again puts up another barrier. Okay, so this is overt. It's seen as a racist thing. We get myths about it. There's, you know, these conspiracy theories and all of that, which just feed into this idea that this is, we're targeted again. Again, we're not being treated equal, and that we're dying because they're not treating us the same as they treat white people. So all of this adds up to the fact that they don't, you know, we don't want to volunteer. We don't want to be in these trials, even though it could be said, look at flu, for example, that we know that they work, but it, sometimes it boils down to, I'd rather take my chances with the disease than take my chances with the people that are telling me that they can develop a vaccine for the disease because they're out to hurt me. I don't trust that it really means that. And if they're going to give anybody, I've heard this, they're going to give anybody, they only want us for the placebo because they're not going to really use the real thing on us. So
how do you overcome that barrier?
Mistrust around so many issues, racism being probably, and poverty being the two greatest.
How do you overcome that barrier,
and that
Phyllis?
People don't look like us.
Phyllis, so. How do you overcome that barrier? That just seems like a huge hurdle.
Education, and I think how I overcome it. So let me give you my own personal experience. I, as a clinician, and I've always believed in clinical trials. I know we need. I know that medicine don't always work. So I know all of the good reasons. I have participated in very, very limited trials. This trial came up, and I can tell you definitively the reason that I got on board with this was because Dr. Branch was a black woman. And she came out, talked to our group. She was a black woman, a woman of faith. She talked to us. I saw her face. I believed her. She gave us all the reasons why it's good. She understands why we didn't do it, why we haven't been doing it, and we need your help. And that sold me. I signed up. I'm going to do it.
And are you a participant in the trial?
I haven't been notified yet.
Haven't been notified. Okay. Yep. Corey and John, two participants, Corey from Rochester, John from Columbus, Ohio. I want to turn back to the idea that a recent Gallup poll found that a third of Americans wouldn't take the vaccine, even if one was approved. What runs through your minds when you hear that so many people wouldn't take the vaccine? Corey, John, who wants to take that?
I can take it. It's John. It disturbs me to hear that, and also hear all the wild, theories that are out there about the vaccine that we've all probably heard in the news. It's quite disappointing, and it's definitely going to have an effect on the ability to gain herd immunity against against this virus.
Corey, you want to chime in?
Yes, I'll just actually echo John's statements. I believe in vaccines, and I believe in helping out where I can. So supporting science by being in this trial is important. And to hear that some people would not take the vaccine once it's approved and rolled out is kind of disturbing, especially 50%. I think that's kind of low. I thought maybe 10% of people would say no, but 50%, that's quite a bit.
Yeah, I think it was 35% in this poll that I saw, the Gallup poll.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But still, a significant number. What, Dr. Walsh, what kind of participation is needed for trials like these to be considered successful? I mean, we're talking about 120 people here in Rochester right now, but what sort of numbers are we looking at globally?
Well, there's studies that are going to go forward, and I want to point out that shortly, the AstraZeneca or Oxford vaccine study will be starting in Rochester. Angela Branch and Ann Falsey and myself will all be participating in that.
When that sounds like new news. When is that actually going to get off the ground, the AstraZeneca trial?
We don't have a firm date, but relatively soon.
But it is confirmed that that's happening here.
That's my understanding, is that it should happen here, yes.
Okay.
In addition, there are other vaccines coming through that may also take place in the Rochester area. As I mentioned earlier, there are about six or seven vaccines that are sort of lined up in various stages of moving forward. And the University of Rochester's Vaccine Trials and Evaluation Unit that Dr. Falsey and Dr. Branch co-direct are contracted to participate in some of those trials. So this will be an evolving situation as we go forward as to what comes about. So each of these trials that are currently in either progress or being planned to begin very shortly have essentially used the same statistical models to determine the size of the studies, and they've all come down with about 30,000 individuals. In some instances, it's half and half. That is 15,000 placebo, 15,000 vaccinees, and others have come out with a slightly different proportion, such as 10,000 placebo and 20,000 vaccinees. And these are studies are designed by statisticians who take into account several factors. One of the key factors is what is the disease activity in the U.S. and in various communities, and therefore what will be the exposure potential of the individuals in the trial, and what would be the expected illness rate in the placebo group and compare it to the vaccinated group. And you throw into this calculation what would you like to see as a outcome, meaning something like 65 to 70% effectiveness. And given that information, the idea is that perhaps by December or January, we might have an answer to the question. Do these vaccines actually prevent illness? We know they're immunogenic.
So
we know they produce the kind of immune response that should be protective, but you have to then demonstrate that. And so generally speaking, it's been thought that by January, answers will be available. Now, those answers may not be the answers we want to see, but we certainly are hopeful, and I think as Dr. Fauci has pointed out, he's optimistic based on the early immunogenicity data that they will be positive.
So, Doctor, you spoke a moment ago about 65 to 75% effectiveness, and I just want to make sure I understand that correctly. Is that to suggest that that's the threshold in which a vaccine would be considered successful, and then if it's administered to people, that means 1 in 4 or possibly 1 in 3 people it would be ineffective on?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the design. The most effective vaccine we have is probably measles, which is about 98% effective. Flu vaccine is usually in the 60% effectiveness range. But when you look at the
annual flu shot that people get.
Exactly.
Okay.
And when you look at a pandemic that has thus far killed over 160,000 individuals, if you had a vaccine that only was 50% effective, that number would be 80,000, or perhaps even greater, because there are three sort of parameters you could look at as an outcome. You could look at actual infection, that is, any sign that you had an infection, which could run from a runny nose to sort of a fever for 3 or 4 days, to severe respiratory disease, meaning pneumonia, that would require hospitalization and perhaps cause death. So you have these various outcomes, and it's quite possible that a vaccine could be more effective, for instance, against developing pneumonia than it would be from preventing infection at all. And so, these are the outcomes that we'd be looking to assess, not just in the vaccine trials, but if a vaccine is to be effective or is found to be effective, you know, what the effect will be once it becomes publicly available. And that data will be also tracked very carefully.
I want to invite, again, listeners to call the show, 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. I have Sue on the line from Fairport, who's been waiting patiently.
Sue. Hi, thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Two questions, actually, one brief. Have you discovered any pre-existing immunities besides the antibodies recently acquired? And then what would you suggest would be the hierarchy of administering the new vaccine, military, medical, maybe even the black and brown community in that order? Thank you.
Dr. Walsh, I'm going to toss these questions to you. Who has the authority, first of all, to decide the hierarchy of who would get the vaccine first?
Yeah, those are very good questions, let me take the first one very quickly. There are four coronaviruses that currently circulate each winter through the community. They cause common cold as well as sometimes bronchitis and even pneumonia, and will occasionally result in severe disease in individuals. There may be some evidence, but it's quite soft at this time, but there is a suggestion that perhaps there is some cross-reactivity, that is, some immunity that has been developed to those viruses might actually carry over into this coronavirus. That is very suggestive data, but it really needs much more work to define it as truth. The second question about the hierarchy of vaccination or the strategy has been laid out by the National Institutes of Health in some of their discussions in terms of who will get vaccinated first, and it will. The hierarchy is those individuals who are at greatest risk for severe disease and for getting infected. So who is at risk for getting infected? Well, you could certainly think about healthcare workers in that group. But I think you also can look at the various communities that have been severely impacted by this virus mm-hmm. as well. And that would include inner cities, various racial and ethnic groups in various socioeconomic situations. You could look at teachers, and you could even look at children, which, by the way, has been a group of individuals that is below age 18 that have not actually been involved in any of the vaccine trials to this point. It would be unusual to start out with children in most vaccine studies. So there is a fair amount of discussion. It will depend on the availability of vaccines. My hope would be that all of the vaccines that go forward into phase 3 studies are proven to be equally effective. This would give us an enormous advantage in terms of production, distribution, and making them available. And they are slightly different in the way they're produced, and it may be even possible that certain populations might do better with one vaccine or another. So I think, these are important questions that you just asked.
Sue, thank you so much for the call and the important questions. Phyllis, I want to turn to you here with what the doctor said regarding the hierarchy or potential hierarchy, that, communities of color may be high on that list because they have been disproportionately affected by the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. What is your sense in that if a vaccine were approved, this isn't medical research, it is now an approved vaccine, what is your sense of how receptive communities of color would be to taking the vaccine? And I ask that, in the context of this Gallup poll that found that 1 in 3 Americans, and I don't know the racial makeup of the respondents, but 1 in 3 Americans said they wouldn't take it. What's your sense in communities of color?
I think it would be a very hard sell. I mean,
even an approved vaccine.
Even an approved vaccine, I think it would be very, very difficult. It's just so such an emotionally charged topic. And so we haven't had, we really did a great push to get people in communities of color to take flu vaccine. And still, we don't get the response that we would like to in communities of color. So this is something that's perceived as worse, as more deadly. And so there's more mistrust. And I just really don't see. That's why we're working so hard, with through Common Ground and other organizations to get this word out, to get people, to inform people about COVID, about the trials, about what they mean, and in a way that they can understand, so that when this vaccine is developed, people will have a better understanding in a way that they really can understand it, how it relates to them, why it's necessary, and then have trusted people in the community that understand it and that can talk to them about it and bring them on board.
You spoke a few moments ago about literacy and what's involved in these trials and just getting started. Corey was kind enough to share some of his paperwork with us, and it's no joke here. I'm looking at 20 pages or so of disclaimers and type text here. It's pretty straightforward language, but it's still a lot of reading. Corey, was it difficult to digest for you? I mean, how long did this take for you to go through it and for you to feel good about it? In the trial.
Yeah, so when you arrive, you work with the nurses, and they provide you with an iPad, and you sit down and read through all of it, and they can answer any questions that you might have. It's actually really well laid out.
It is pretty friendly. But there are terms like observer blind study, you know, mm-hmm. not exactly known to everyone.
And so that's a good point. When I went for both of my appointments at RGH, Dr. Walsh was there. He was available to answer any questions, too. So they're right on task to help answer any questions that you might have with the readings or the process.
Got another caller on the line. This is William in Pittsford. William, thanks for listening. We've got a few minutes left, so fire away.
Well, I'd like to have Dr. Walsh, as a vaccinologist expert, explain what it is that has made it so uniquely rapid a process to get this vaccine done when vaccines have typically taken several years. At best, I read in the Wall Street Journal today that there already had been work being done by the Trump administration's committee or group back in 2019 to prepare for a vaccine. So if you could give us a little insight, you know, why this warp speed, why it's working so well, and does it have something to do with work that was already in place back in 2019? Thank you.
Thank you, sure, William. Thanks
for that question. It is one of the things that actually has worked incredibly well. The groundwork had been laid, actually, for the development of a coronavirus vaccine and for response to a coronavirus pandemic over the past 15 years, especially over the last 5 or 6 years. As scientists in many laboratories, including friends of mine at the NIH, had worked out the parameters that would be required for having a vaccine available almost instantly prior to the occurrence of this identification of this pandemic. And therefore, it was actually not a surprise to many of us in the infectious disease community to see that vaccines were essentially ready to go, at least into the animal trials, within a week or two of the identification of the sequence of this virus, which occurred in early part of January. So all the basic research groundwork had actually already been done in anticipation of a possible coronavirus pandemic. You know, the pandemic preparedness has identified those viruses, which would include, for instance, bird flu, as well as the coronaviruses, as serious threats. And, you know, very fortunately, some very, very good work by some very smart people had really set us up in such a way, and not just in one potential platform to produce vaccines, but in multiple ways.
Dr. Walsh, we are running out of time here, and I want to ask you a question about the manufacturing capabilities that are needed to produce a vaccine on a mass scale. Do you foresee, does the medical community in the United States foresee that there'll be collaboration between companies? I mean, if this Pfizer vaccine, say, is successful, could it be manufactured by other companies as well?
Well, I guess I'm not really aware of the information I'd need to answer that question directly.
Okay.
I don't know.
I mean, I guess what I'm asking
and
is
the companies are certainly collaborating on that approach.
I guess what I'm asking is, do you foresee it being a team effort once one is successful? Do you imagine companies and countries sharing that information in order to produce?
Certainly hope that can be arranged. I am unaware though of specifics regarding that situation.
Okay. Dr. Walsh, Dr. Ed Walsh, he is the professor of infectious diseases at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He's also on the URMC's vaccine research team. I thank you so much for your time today. It's been an interesting conversation, and I think very helpful to a lot of people. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Phyllis Jackson, registered nurse and community wellness project manager at Common Ground Health. Thank you for all the work you're doing on this issue.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us. And Corey Talenda and John Gunn, both coronavirus vaccine trial participants, Corey in Rochester, John in Columbus, Ohio. Thank you so much for sharing your perspectives today and joining the program. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you all for joining us today and listening. A very special thank you to Rob Braden, the engineer for Connections, and Megan Mack, the show's producer, for holding my hand as I play host this week. This show could not happen without both of them, and I am grateful for their assistance. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good day.